Hello and welcome to the next episode of Code and Beyond, a podcast where we talk about software development and anything beyond that. Today it's going to be about microservices and monoliths. My name is Alex, and I'm here together with my friend Pablo. Awesome. Okay, once again.
Yeah, let's try again.
Hello and welcome to the next episode of Code and Beyond, a podcast where we talk about software development and anything beyond that. Today it's going to be about microservices and monolith. My name is Alex and I'm here together with my friend Pablo. Hi Pablo.
Hello Alex.
So the topic is about monoliths and microservices. That's the quite hot one, and I guess it's one of the popular questions during interviews. And I spotted that sometimes when you talk about software, it's easy to imagine that anything is possible. Right? You could build any software because it's not a physical object, right? There is no borders for your imagination even sometimes. But when you apply kind of the same ideas to something from physical world, from real offline life, then you could feel that some things could be hard. Let's say you wanna build a hotel, right? That's your product. Mm-hmm. So and you have two options. You could build a huge house. So you want to build a nice hotel, right? With different, not just rooms for people, but I don't know, with swimming pool, with spa. You could build like a huge house with the multiple floors, and each floor could have different services. That's the one approach. Then you could imagine, okay, on which floors you have swimming pools, spas, or whatever, whether the rooms, whether the restaurant and all these things, you know that you have N teams serving all these things. It's all good. It's totally perfect approach. It would work. But then at some point, what if you want to have more people, right? Or when your hotel is so awesome that people just come to you every day, like thousands of people, and they want to be in this place. You have no room. You cannot build one more floor on top of it. It's impossible, right? It could be even dangerous. What if the swimming pool is not big enough, right? Or something like this. Or your spa is so awesome that it cannot serve this. You could extend it, like on the site, you could build something, but then it doesn't look nice anymore, or you might not have land to build this, right? And then you're kind of stuck. So you could build similar building somewhere else, right? And then have like two things. Another approach would be, what if you have enough land to build smaller houses, and the one would be just for rooms where people sleep and stay. Another house would be swimming pool, another spa, and then so on and so on. So if you need yet another pool or yet another spa, you just build similar house, right? Then you have less limits. But in case of this multiple houses approach, you also need to take into account that there should be connections, like pathways between these houses. You have to take care of them, right? And most probably you need separate teams to serve all these houses, right? Because with one team, when it's one building, they don't have to literally walk between these houses and spend time on this. It's much easier to use elevator and then go on any floor. You need less people. Let's say you have one team to clean everything, and that's it. If you have multiple houses, one team is not enough. You need multiple teams doing the same work. And maybe these teams would be assigned to these houses, so they never leave them. They don't have to walk all these pathways, which is additional stress on everything, right? You need to manage people. Sometimes these people might not have work because everything is fine, so you cannot fire them, but you need to keep them just in case, like all these things. Some of these pathways, they might be damaged, let's say, right? It's a silly example, but because of bad weather or something, so you have to repair them. The problem which you don't have if you have one building. Mm-hmm. You have different sets of problems in each scenario, and none of them is actually right or wrong, right? They all work. They all have cons and pros. In my opinion, it's very similar to monolith approach and microservices approach, right?
Yeah.
And you need to know which approach works for you depending on your situation, right? On your resources and I guess on your plans in the future.
Yeah.
Because sometimes just one building and not multiple could serve you perfectly fine forever, and you will be happy with this. And so you don't even need all this multiple houses approach. You don't need microservices. So that's the picture. That's an analogy from real world yet in my head this morning.
It's a nice one, yeah. And I just thought that one thing that you can do to mitigate microservices approach, so you mentioned that problem you have when you have only one building and you don't know how to cope with the demand, you don't know how to spend. So you have one option there. You can raise the prices, mm-hmm. and then you will have less people that can afford it.
Yeah, but more money, maybe.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, but it's a really nice analogy. I like it.
But if you would go with one of these approaches, what would you recommend based on your personal experience?
As you mentioned, it depends a lot on the type of the company, the type of the business, the team you have, and the thing that you're trying to build. Personally, I like small teams, small companies, because it's usually easier to manage. So a monolith can take you quite far, right? Until you really need to start to split things apart. It depends a lot of the shape of the team. If you want to go from day one with independent teams, and you have service that is clear, that is totally independent from the rest of the architecture, it's also a good approach to go with one service and another kind of a monolith. I heard the name Citadel. So you have a monolith, mm-hmm. and then you have citadels around the monolith.
Okay.
So they are like services, but you don't have a microservices architecture. Not everything is a service that are interconnected and so mm-hmm. on. So you have one kind of a monolith that is serving most of the requests, and then you have small services that take care of a very specific core area of your business. Mm-hmm. That's also a nice approach.
Isn't it this service-oriented architecture, which was before microservices, when you have basically a bunch of applications in this kind of terms? So they are not micro, they are not small, but they serve one purpose, one domain. Mm-hmm. They almost independent from each other. So they work as a team kind of, but they could also work independently. In microservices, no, they serve one tiny feature of bigger thing.
Yeah. To be honest, I'm still a bit confused between microservices and service-oriented architectures and all the names that we have out there. Because they sometimes when you talk to people, they talk about microservices, but in your mind, in your brain, you're talking about the service. What you have in your mind is like a service, or not a microservice. But it's like naming is difficult.
Yeah, no one knows what is microservice.
Yeah.
How to make it, right? That's the biggest problems, I guess. Let's say you started with monolith and then you read an article somewhere or you visited a conference where everyone is talking how awesome it is to have microservices and this is the way.
Yeah.
And of course, inspired by these people, you try to have something like this. But then you discover that you need to define all these domain entities, right? You have to define boundaries between them and you have to do it right. Because if you do it wrong, then you have to roll back and redo this the work that you did before, which might be painful or not even possible sometimes.
Communication between services is probably the trickiest part, right?
Yes.
So usually when you have a monolith, a CRUD base app, everything goes through the database, which is also a problem because you are coupled to the data model. That's one of the biggest issues you find in classic Rails apps. Mm-hmm. But then when you go with the services that they are not so tied to database, you still need to provide a mechanism to communicate between them, right? You need to send messages through the different services. You either go with a event bus or you either go with a message queue or something. Or you go over HTTP, like an API. You could say that the communication between an API, an HTTP API and a client is kind of a service-oriented architecture, isn't it?
Sometimes, let's say you have one action performed by the user or by the client, mm-hmm. but it involves calls to multiple microservices, and then you have to decide whether it goes synchronously or asynchronously. Let's say it's asynchronous, so you respond to the client, everything is fine, because the client supplied perfect payload, everything is correct with the data, mm-hmm. but you failed somewhere on the way. But the client already got a successful response. What needs to happen then? You have to come up with some abstractions on top of it. So if it would be a monolith, then it would be a transaction and database, right? You have mm-hmm. multiple operations, changing something, changing data here and there, but it's one transaction and then it's either committed or rolled back.
Yeah.
And it's synchronous, so the client knows exactly whether it was success or failure for real. In microservices, you need to come up with these distributed transactions. But it's yet another layer to support, yet another layer to implement. it doesn't make everything easier. It does work. It fixes this problem. Mm-hmm. You need to know about this upfront before you decide to go microservice way. So it doesn't come for free, even if it's after watching videos or reading books. It looks like, yeah, that's so awesome. You could assign teams to each service. They work absolutely independently. You have this freedom of choosing tools and programming languages and frameworks, yeah, data stores, and so on. Looks awesome. And it is awesome, but it comes with the price. And sometimes you know chunks of this price upfront, even from these mm-hmm. books or conferences, and something you discover along the way already based on your experience. Because I guess every company and every product unique in the way it's built.
Yeah, they are all unique.
Yeah.
And the thing is, they are unique because teams are unique.
Yes.
So the pool of talent you have is unique in every single company. And the shape of the team, everything is unique. And you always face very specific challenges when you're in a different company.
Yeah. So it's not possible to find a book which says, okay, these are the rules, this is the scenario. If you follow this scenario, everything will be absolutely perfect or 95% perfect. No. Otherwise, we won't have a job, which is also good.
Yeah, true thing. Yeah. I think to me, the biggest benefit from microservices is the everything can be synchronous. So you get a lot of decoupling from, you can decouple a lot your services from the main logic or the main monolith. That usually is a good benefit, but as you mentioned, usually comes with the price of, you pay the price and then the network or on the message pass or the communication layer. It's also true that I don't know why when we talk about microservices, we always think about distributed systems. So you have a service in X server, or you have Lambda functions that are in different, you don't know where they are living, so they are apart from on the network. So the example you mentioned with the tiny houses interconnected by roads. Mm-hmm. So that's the first thing that comes to our mind. But I think it's possible to build the same architecture under the same server, right?
Yep.
So the base is that you need asynchronous calls. So you need to send messages to a queue, something like that, and you need to consume events. So the services don't know anything about the other services. I think that's kind of the basic thing that you want to accomplish. So you can have everything in one server, and you can have a message bus running in that server, and you can have services that emit commands to that message bus, and all the services consuming and emitting events, and everything can live in the monolith. So it's still a monolith that behaves like a microservice.
Yeah, then it depends on what is monolith. Is it the server, like the runtime environment? It's the monolithic application of your service, right? Or the thing that you build.
Those two terms are tricky for me. Still don't know how to paint them in my mind. It's like monolith and microservice. To me, it's a bunch of technologies that you can use to solve different problems, and they play nicely in some environments and challenges, and they don't play so nice in others. It's like if you're in a startup and you're starting a project from scratch and you don't know what you're going to build, and if you go all the way with the tiny microservices that are talking to each other over the network, I think that's overkill, right?
That was my question. I wanted to ask, if you would start Greenfield project from scratch, what would you pick, monolith or microservice?
You need to build something quick with a CRUD approach and check the product, right? You need to check the market and check if you have a market fit with your product. So I don't know. It's like the easiest and the fastest is not going to be microservice.
Yes, monolith gives you flexibility, right? It's like with this, so we were talking about databases some time ago, relational versus NoSQL approach, yeah, right? And relational gives you this flexibility. So if you don't know query patterns, it's better to go, it's safer kind of to go with relational databases, because you could adapt and you could change them while you discover your needs. The same with monolith. So you could explore your ideas or explore different directions even.
Yeah.
With microservices, it's already when you have at least the base of what you need, So you understand this, and then you build this platform, and then you could scale it. And most probably at this point, you already have enough people.
Yeah. Yeah. People are super afraid of hear the word rewrite, but I don't think it's so bad. So if you start company and you have a, you quickly build something and you find market fit, and then you know that you're going to grow, and now you have the requirements way more clear than before, I think it's totally fine to go with a rewrite if you need it, if you need to change architecture, because now you know that the requirements are not going to fit in this specific monolith that you have or this specific architecture, and you have to change path. I don't know why people is super scared about rewriting or rewriting parts of your app. And if you do it in time, I think it's fine. If you wait too much, then probably it's too late because you already have a business running on it, and to change because, yeah, it's making money. No one wants to break it. But if you pick the right time to go for a rewrite, I think it can be nice and can be helpful for the company in the future.
Yep, and there are patterns already, like well-defined with years of experience, how to transform from monolith if it's necessary to microservices. Yep. But what I wanted to stress in this case is that I've seen examples when people start something with the idea in mind, yeah, we will start with monolithic approach because it's faster, flexibility, this is what we know because we just explore, and we will then rebuild everything. And that's why this initial product that they have code-wise is not that well built.
Mm-hmm.
Then in this case, you most probably will have to rewrite it literally from scratch, use this experience that you have, knowledge that you already possess, but build it from scratch.
Yeah.
If you would build this initial product, even with the idea in mind that there will be like evolutionary step and maybe there will be microservices in the end, it would be much easier if this product would be still well built with the clear separation between modules and then well-defined entities and so on. Then this the next step towards to whatever architecture is easier, right? Because you have these boundaries already within monolith. If you would like to extract something into another application and then grow this part independently, it's much easier to do.
Yeah, for sure. If the code is well done, it's going to be even easier to reason about it, right?
Yeah.
So I'm not saying that just go and do things wherever you want without following any good practice. No, I'm telling that you can go quite far with a tiny approach. Like you don't have to go with a like we said the other day, you don't have to go with DynamoDB from day one because you don't know the access patterns. But you can start with, you can even start, you mentioned that, like with something like SQLite, right? Which is tiny database that can get you far enough to get a better grasp of your business. But that doesn't mean that you have to write crappy code.
Totally, right.
So you can focus on quality and deliver a nice tiny application that is not ready to deal with thousands and thousands of millions of users.
Yeah.
Because that's not part of your plan right now.
And that's okay, right?
And that's totally fine. And then when you have the problem of, okay, now my business is super successful, I really want to grow, or I really want to expand to the whole world, then you have to sit again and think about your architecture, and maybe it's time to go for a rewrite of some parts, change your database. And you don't even need a relational database anymore. It's fine. But yeah, you get to that point with a tiny infrastructure that allowed you to grow with a small team. And yeah, so different companies, different times in the development requires different approaches. And yeah, I never talk about writing crappy code. Try to write the best code you can.
Yes, at any point of time.
Yeah, yeah. Otherwise, your future self is going to hate you.
It's not bad to start simple.
Yeah.
No one says that your product is, I don't know, not that cool because you decided to make simple steps and then have evolution and not revolutionary steps. As then when you rewrite your product every 2 years or every 5 years from scratch, right? You just add and extend and then react on changes on the market, on demand approach with less stress, I would say, on everyone.
To me, it's being pragmatic. Apply the technology that applies right now and we'll see in the future.
Yeah.
Another thing that I usually see, and I did it myself, is like try to apply a technology that you are learning about or it's cool and you really want to try. even if it doesn't really apply to the to the business that you're working on. Common, it's quite common pattern among developers. We are tech people, and we really like to play around with the new technology, new language, new framework, and so on. So sometimes we may make mistakes because of that. We go, as you mentioned, we go to a conference, we read the last book about microservices, and you think, whoa, this is gonna solve all of my problems. It's so cool. It is for the problem that book or the conference talk describes, but yeah, as you mentioned, doesn't have to apply to your world.
Speaking of books, could you recommend something on topic of microservices or monoliths, maybe?
I started some time ago, maybe 1 year or something like that. I started to read one book, which is called Microservices. it's Practical Microservices, which is in the Pragmatic bookshelf. I really like it, but I stop. You know, you start a book and then life happens and you stop to read it and you don't finish it. Mm-hmm. And I'm planning to start again with it because I was really enjoying it. It's a very practical book. So they build a system from scratch so you can follow along. I think it's Node.js, JavaScript. Mm-hmm. But it's fine that the code is simple enough that you can follow along if you're coming from, I don't know, Java, Ruby, or any other high-level language. I would recommend that book, even I haven't finished it. The part I read, I really like it so far, and I'm planning to give it another try.
Link will be in show notes. For sure.
Yeah.
So I think that's it, right?
Yeah, I think we can wrap it up. I saw that you have some shout-outs, don't you?
Yes. I have two things to mention from this week. So the first one, it's called SyncThing, which is software to synchronize files between machines. Mm-hmm. It's open source, written in Go. It's super stable, never had any issues with it. I started using it because of Obsidian. So you inspired me to switch to Obsidian. So now I'm in the process of migrating from Notion to Obsidian. Mm-hmm. And because of this, I have a problem, right? With Notion, everything is in the cloud and you don't care about synchronization. It's done for you. Obsidian is a local resource. They provide synchronization service, but then you have to pay for it. Mm-hmm. And again, it's in the cloud. So you still have option to manage everything yourself. This is what I did. So Obsidian works with the Markdown files on my local machine.
Yeah.
But I also wanted to have these nodes on smartphone. So I installed this sync thing, pointed it to local directories, and now it synchronizes everything almost instantly. So it takes a second or so. It doesn't take much resources. Can highly recommend this tool.
Is it in the cloud or?
No, it's from one machine to, it's peer-to-peer. Yes, and you could have a fleet of your machines, right? You could you could run it on Raspberry Pi as well. And it just makes sure that the files are in sync between all these machines. You could specify different types of access. So the folder could be read-write, could be read-only or write-only. It's up to you to define.
Yeah.
You have to manually connect these machines, but it's just you scan QR code and that's it. So the one machine could say, I'm sharing this folder, and you need to add other machines to also have access to this folder.
So it's the access is folder-based?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
And another thing to mention this week is NeoVim. So I used NeoVim for, I don't know, more than a year already. Mm-hmm. And from the version 0.5, they have Lua built in.
Yeah.
Like normally you have Vim script, and now you could have two languages. So I decided to switch to Lua. This is just experiments I'm doing in a separate machine, not in the work machine. But I switched my Vim init file into Lua. Now everything written is in Lua.
Yeah.
Because of this, I discovered different sets of plugins which are written just in Lua. So it's pure Lua language.
Yeah.
And I really like them. So they look really modern to me. Yeah, I'm playing with this. Still, it's not production ready on my machine yet.
Yeah.
But I'm having fun with this.
Yeah, maybe I should give it a try. I'm still using Vim, not NeoVim.
So these are two things that I wanted to mention this week. Okay, that's it for today. Thanks for listening. In case of any questions, simply send us an email. You will find our address in the show notes. Keep being amazing. Bye.
Bye.